When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition comic book podcast, where we discuss the famous, infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr. With me, as always,
Brian Reese. You are Paul Matthew Carr.
I am, and you are Brian Reese. Hello.
I am, allegedly.
No, I think it's been proven. You are, in fact, Brian Reese. So today on the program, we'll be discussing Shang-Chi, Master of Kung Fu, Weapon of the Soul, the Epic Collection, which is very, very long. But I hope you'll get a kick out of it.
Oh.
Hey. Before we get into that, let's talk about a movie that was released just a couple of days ago at the time of this recording, The Suicide Squad.
Not to be confused with Suicide Squad.
Exactly, because this is The Suicide Squad. Yes. This is the James Gunn-directed bloody kill fest that all I can say is, Zack Snyder better start taking some notes, because this is how you do it.
This is how you do it.
What did you think of the Suicide Squad, right?
Oh, well, so I just watched it last night. I waited an extra day. We're recording on a Sunday, so I watched it on a Saturday. Because that's when you watch movies. Okay.
Yeah.
I guess you could.
I guess Friday, so. No. Saturday. No, actually. Oh, man. It was Friday. I had to call someone to get their password so that I could watch it. I mean, I actually have HBO.
Right. You paid
yeah,
for
yeah.
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This is the part we cut out.
Look, someone did pay for it. I'll tell you, it blew my mind, like many of the characters in this movie. Oh, by the way, spoilers, if you haven't seen this, you know, fast forward along. I say I'll put time codes in the show notes, but I won't. So just fast forward till we're done talking. This movie is really quite amazing.
It's batshit crazy.
Isn't it, though?
Yeah.
I just love the fact that the opening scene kills off everybody.
Well, I mean, but that's the spirit of the comic, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I don't know if you noticed this, but the doctor who implants the bombs in the back of their neck
is John Ostrander.
Is John Ostrander, exactly. Yes. There's so many little cameos like that throughout this movie.
Which is great, and I appreciate that. And I we should say off the bat, let's, you know, the elephant in the room, as it were. The first Suicide Squad movie was awful.
Yeah, it was really bad.
I mean, I think it's widely known that it's one of the very worst of the worst.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of talk now that there's going to be a director's cut in the same vein as Zack Snyder to, you know, put the original vision forward. But
it'll be like 12 hours long?
Yeah, I can't see. I just think it'll be a more coherent version of a mediocre movie.
Yeah,
it's just not that good.
I couldn't do an hour and a half of the first one. I can't possibly sit through anything further. That said, what a vast improvement.
Oh my goodness. It's night and day when you have someone who, like James Gunn, who knows the material and appreciates the material and wants to have fun with it. And because, you know, he's having a boatload of fun playing with the conventions of comic books and using a lot of source material, but riffing on it and making it and making it his own. And it's just so fun to watch someone having fun.
When the actors actually seem like they're enjoying being in the film, we don't have, say, somebody going so method that they lose the point of. I'm not referring to Margot Robbie, who is the perfect film Harley Quinn, right? Even in the previous iteration, I mean, Margot Robbie is, it's one of those perfect casting moments.
Oh yeah, she's great. And she was great in Birds of Prey too. She's wonderful.
And she's almost a secondary character.
Oh, I know. Well, she has her own little, kind of mini movie in the middle of the film.
Right. Yeah. But I think what's great about, you know, this is that it's not just the Harley Quinn show.
And it's not just the Will Smith show.
Right. But no, I mean, the fact that every character gets there, and some of them, you know, again, when I say that she's secondary in terms of screen time, I mean, I think Idris and Ratcatcher 2, I didn't time things, so I don't know for certain, but it allowed some of these other characters to really kind of blossom and be interesting. And I understand, like, for some folks, they could never have too much Idris Elba screen time. I live with somebody who
I'm actually there
would like to have as much Idris Elba time as possible in all of the films she watches.
I'm kind of there as well.
Yeah.
I think so. Even Peacemaker, which is a character I don't really care for, John Cena just made it so fun.
Yes. You know? And it's what is weird, what is interesting is I didn't have a lot of investment in the idea of like a Peacemaker TV show.
I know.
That's coming up, right? With and I appreciate John Cena as a human and as a person. persons are generally human, but not necessarily. You know, I'm not a wrestling guy. So, but I am now officially interested in the Peacemaker TV show that's coming out.
Me too. And when you learned that it was just sort of, apparently it was written by James Gunn during lockdown just for something to do because he needed, right. You know, he needed something to occupy his mind. And then he took it to Warner Brothers, I guess, and just said, would you like to do this? And they were like, yeah, sure. Oh, man. Yeah, I'm actually looking forward to it.
I think we should point out this is an insanely violent movie.
Oh, it's violent and bloody. And
I mean, there's great scene where Peacemaker and who's Elba's character, Bloodsport.
Yeah.
Bloodsport. They're just randomly killing people, but they're doing dick measuring.
Yes.
And yeah. So the whole sequence is them coming up with new and interesting ways to kill somebody.
Yeah, it's so funny. There's a scene where, or there are part of that scene where Peacemaker just walks past someone sleeping and machetes him as he casually walks past. Yeah. And it's horrifying, but so funny at the exact same time.
So, yeah, I mean, so this is not for the faint of heart, and it's certainly not.
Well, the very first thing.
Somebody who advocates violence just for the sake of violence, it just entertained me. Am I not entertained? I am entertained.
And there's one thing, if you want to compare the two movies, there's really no comparison, but I will. So the original Suicide Squad, when they introduced all the characters, it was done in this very haphazard way where they, you know, all their name and statistics came on the screen and it was very in your face. In this one, they do it by very funny ways. Like, first of all, there's employees looking at everyone's file and then taking bets on which one's going to die.
Yeah, that's a good scene.
But you get to know who all these people are but while being entertained. And then
it's a classic show, don't tell.
Right. And then you get the full-on introduction of Bloodsport, laying down all the things that he's done. But then you get the exact same introduction for Peacemaker, because Amanda Waller describes them both the same way. And that's what starts their rivalry.
Right.
It's really cleverly done. Yeah, it's leaps and bounds above the original.
I mean, I think that there are, like, some people will point out, I think some folks already have, and it's fair. There are some Guardians of the Galaxy comparisons.
Well, it's the same guy.
That right. Can be made. And that's fine, because at the end of the day, this is a three arc. This movie does follow the standard three arc.
You know, three act. Sort of, yeah.
Right, the three-act sort of idea. And I love the fact that James Gunn has brought in a lot of the actors from the Marvel Universe.
I mean, Taika Waititi does a cameo.
Right. Yeah. Michael Rooker, who's great. Michael Rooker is always great, though.
Well, Michael Rooker, he's not just a Marvel character. He's in every single James Gunn movie.
Right.
So, yeah. So that's like his guy.
As is, and I love this, as a Gilmore Girls fan, is there never a bad time to bring in Sean Gunn, James Gunn's brother?
Absolutely.
And James Gunn puts his brother in every film too. And I like Sean Gunn in general, like whatever he's in, but he gets double duty in this.
I know. He gets to be Calendar Man too, which
he gets to be Calendar Man for like 3 seconds, and he gets to be Weasel.
Oh man, there's that one. It's getting a lot of play online, but you know what he says, TDK, the detachable
kid. Billions, right. Yeah.
But they're like, so your name is letters? Every name is letter. Every name is letters, dickhead. Great joke.
And that's a great cameo too.
Yes.
I don't know if it counts as a cameo because he's in it long enough.
What, Nathan Fillion, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
As TDK.
I mean, just the fact that James Gunn put in people like Arm Fallout Boy and Starro the Conqueror, for God's sakes.
And the Starro thing is fantastic because they don't even try. They're like, this is, it's Bebo, right?
I mean, right, yeah.
I'm making, obviously, a Legends of Tomorrow reference.
But then on a dime, it turns tragic when he says, I was just floating and looking at the stars.
Right.
It's like, aw, poor old Starro. Yeah. I mean, you killed dozens and dozens of people, but hundreds of people.
Hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
You know, Starro is like, but it's Starro is, Starro's a guy in a suit. And it's so intentional. It's such a ridiculous, you know, concept, because Starro's kind of a ridiculous concept. And absolutely, it works well in the comics, right? Because you don't have to, you know, comics is such a great medium when you're trying to translate it to a big screen. I think the way they present Starro is awesome. It's so good. And it's funny, but it's also, you know, it's a terrifying creature at the end of the day. You know, I mean, there's some really gross things that happen in this comic or in this movie, too. I just think that this movie was a hell of a lot of fun. And I mean, it's up there. I had one person on in some social media world who was like, they were like, this movie is better than the Christopher Nolan Batman films. And he was like, you know, fight me.
You know what? I'd have to say, absolutely, it's better than that. Maybe it's just new in my mind right now, but I thoroughly enjoyed this movie. Like, opening frame to the closing credits, I was like, this is great. I cared about a plague of rats and felt sympathetic. Yes. So that's a movie doing its job.
I cared about a guy who like shoots polka dots, and, which actually is a very tragic character.
Yes. And you know, whoever, I don't know who the actress is who played his mother, but kudos to her for that dance scene. There's like 12 people, all her, and she's making them each unique as she's dancing.
Right.
It's like, right, yes, on. That is fantastic.
I mean, there is a lot that happens. And you know, there's actually, you know, it's weird because it actually has some heart, right? I mean, yeah.
And poor Milton. I cared about Milton.
Yeah, Milton. Poor Milton.
Poor Milton. And Harley didn't even, he held the door open for Harley and she did not even remember him.
Well, you know, sometimes Harley doesn't live in the same reality that the rest of us does.
Yes.
Me am English, that the rest of us do.
There's so many little details, like in Harley's hallucination or fantasy with the Disney stuff and all the flowers, mm-hmm, during her killing spree. After she starts killing people, if all the little birds that were following her get horrified and they start hiding behind pillars and things.
Yeah.
Well, it's like, and little that's, details great, like that are perfect.
It's a great sequence. I would like to ask, you know, because I know James Gunn is listening to this, and I would like to ask James Gunn, why do you hate birds?
Well, no, the bird does get to eat Savant's head after he gets blown up. So it's full circle.
But then he like torches that bird sanctuary.
Oh yeah. Well, it's a metaphor.
There's a thing with birds in this. So
well, it's a metaphor. Birds are.
Is he making a birds of prey?
No, birds are you know, free, and you know, you can't, when you cage a bird, you inherently.
Yeah, but when you go back to watch this again, and I know you will, there's a bird thing throughout this entire film.
We'll have to come up with a bird theory,
yeah,
of what it means. But absolutely wonderful. I love the misdirect of starting out with Savant looking like he's going to be the POV character. Just right. Boom, done, gone.
And he turns... I don't want to give too well. I mean,
No, we're already giving it away. I mean, I thought immediately when Captain Boomerang just gets destroyed, I was like, wow, they killed Jai Courtney. Holy crap. Like in the first 10 minutes of the film, they killed Jai Courtney. You know, the ball's on James Gunn. Good for you, buddy.
It's good to see James Gunn being able, like, I would love to see James Gunn take over as the architect of the DC universe over Zack Snyder.
Absolutely.
Because DC needs that, right? I mean, it's like, in the Marvel universe, like people actually sat down and thought through stuff, right? I mean, and they have their phases and whatever else, and it's everything builds on it. You know, I know that this is either a very popular opinion or a very unpopular opinion, depending on who you talk to. I think Zack Snyder's garbage.
Yeah, I mean, he knows how to frame an image, but yeah,
all of his
he's so cynical, and he doesn't like the characters he's creating, and that comes through. And that comes through. Whereas even the characters that James Gunn eviscerates, you can tell he has an affection for them. It's like, I love you so much, I'm going to kill you in a magnificent way.
Right. All of everybody dies terribly, but in a very creative way.
Absolutely. And there's things like, you know, we won't get into James Gunn's past too much, but he does, I mean, he has Rick Flag wear that t-shirt that says obstacles are opportunities, which, you know, that's very meta. But the, you know, the key to James Gunn is he said, I'm sorry, I'll never do it again. And he never has. So kudos to him, I guess.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is, I'm almost at a loss for words. Now, granted, I just watched it last night. It's been 12 hours since I've watched the movie. So it's pretty fresh in my mind. I'm still pretty enthusiastic. And obviously, I will watch it again. Hopefully, it holds up on second viewings. But I just had a blast watching this film in a way that I have not enjoyed a DC. Well, the first Wonder Woman, I really enjoyed. But I don't think I enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed this.
No, this is undoubtedly my favorite of the DC Universe films. Yeah. Hands down. I really did enjoy Birds of Prey, which also has a similar fun, easygoing approach, not as dark and cynical, even though there's, again, violence and death in that one as well. Even more than Marvel, DC is fun. You know, DC comics are really, really fun and crazy and out there, and they have larger than life characters.
It's such a rich history. And it's a rich history of, yeah, I mean, because DC was fun for a long time before the grim and gritty. And I like some of the grim and gritty, or, you know, that's fine. And there's some really good stuff that came out of that period, but not everything has to be.
Right. And the reason that's good is because punk, it's not everything. Right. You know, you have the fun DC universe, and then it's punctuated by this grim and gritty. And made, you know, but that's not overwhelming. That's not, you know, that's not the overarching theme of DC comics.
And DC has, some people might just say, you're a Marvel guy, and I get that, but I think DC has a richer history of characters. They're older.
Deeper, definitely. You know, there's more.
It's a deeper bench. Now, Marvel's great, don't get me wrong. And Marvel has created incredibly fun, great characters. One of my current favorites is still the Orb.
He gets around. It's okay to acknowledge the goofiness of comics. And Marvel movies actually got better once they started doing that, because they started very grounded, you know, still on the lighter fun edge, but they were very grounded, like this could happen in real life. And once the MCU opened up to, this is just batshit insane, it's gotten so much better. And I think DC needs to embrace that as well.
I would like to see DC unclench a little bit more.
We never really talked about it, but the Snyder Cut, it's fine.
I couldn't watch it.
Yeah.
I don't have 12 hours to watch up.
I'll admit it took me several days to get through it, but it's fine. But it's not something I'll ever revisit, and it's not something I want to see in the future. Whereas
superhero films shouldn't be Battleship Potemkin.
Right. Exactly. Yes. We're not doing some Ayn Randian objectivism, you know, thesis. This Suicide Squad, the Suicide Squad. That's what I want. You know, you can tone it down for like Shazam. You don't have to have it so bloody.
Right. Yeah. I mean, but this is an R-rated film. This is a hard R, you know.
Oh, yeah.
This is like Deadpool, if we want to pick a Marvel equivalent.
Yeah. No, I think Deadpool would look at this and go, damn.
Nothing like Deadpool. I'm not trying to compare the two in terms.
Well, no. What I'm saying is, you know, James Gunn.
But this is hard R in the way that Deadpool is for the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Okay, so anyway, Suicide Squad. If you haven't seen it, sorry, we spoiled everything for you. But go watch it because it's fun. Other than that, It's good. Comic book movies should be fun. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about a comic book that's interesting.
Well, that's a word for it. And we're back. So, Paul, today we are going to be discussing your recommendation. And your recommendation is the epic collection of the first 500 or 600 issues of Shang-Chi.
Yeah, sorry about that.
It's almost like having to read 21 issues of G.I. Joe.
Yeah, we gotta narrow this down.
Would you like to tell us about your selection?
I sure could. In the 1970s, there was a craze for martial arts that swept the nation. There were many factors that led to this craze, but one person that personified the popularity of martial arts was, of course, Bruce Lee. Lee's popularity at this time was so huge that it led to a proliferation of classes and studios and dojos all across the U.S. for people of all backgrounds to learn and practice martial arts. So much so, it's fair to say that in the 1970s, everyone was kung fu fighting. And now Marvel was no stranger to jumping on bandwagons, and they did so by creating several martial arts themed publications and characters based on Bruce Lee, including the most prominent and lasting Iron Fist and the one we'll be talking about today, Shang-Chi, the Master of Kung Fu. Now, in order to understand this comic better, we need to talk about the other major development that was happening at Marvel at this time, and that is that Marvel had obtained the rights to use the characters of Sax Rohmer, specifically Fu Manchu. Now, if you're not familiar with the works of Sax Rohmer, good. But the short version is that Fu Manchu is the embodiment of yellow peril. This is every negative stereotype about Asian people you can think of, and probably some more that Rohmer invented himself. Picture every colonialist fears personified. And in order to weave these two things together, Shang-Chi was made to be Fu Manchu's son. So the origin of Shang-Chi and his early stories are intrinsically tied to Fu Manchu, which is troubling. And it adds a layer of uncomfortableness to his story. With that being said, the creators, mostly Doug Monk and Paul Galassi, but there are many others, they attempted to give Shang-Chi a distinctive style, with varying results. After breaking with his father, Shang-Chi sets off on a quest to topple Fu Manchu's empire. A meandering, often directionless quest, but a quest nonetheless. Along the way, he joins up with a couple of British stereotypes, Sir Dennis and Blackjack Tar, while battling a near-endless supply of martial arts-themed villains, the breadth and variety of which would make Cobra Commander jealous. These stories are told with narration by Shang-Chi in a sort of distant voice that fluctuates between being a detached observer to a dispenser of sage wisdom. The effect is inconsistent, but interesting. It's probably the most distinct element of these early issues and the one thing that sets it apart from other Marvel titles at the time. But much like the stories themselves, Shang-Chi as a character is directionless, floating from location to location, set piece to set piece, seemingly with no end goal in sight. And while the fight scenes and action are presented well and look great most of the time, it ultimately goes nowhere. Shang-Chi is presented as part spiritual wanderer and part international spy on a path of revenge that never really gets developed. Now, in later years, uncoupled from the baggage of Fu Manchu, Shang-Chi's motivations were able to become something more cohesive and his character given proper development. In these early stories, however, Shang-Chi in the Master of Kung Fu series was ultimately just a bunch of good ideas combined with excellent fight choreography, desperately in need of a purpose. Brian, what did you think of Shang-Chi, Master of Kung Fu? I was being kind.
This is rough reading.
Sorry about that. Is this just going to be an episode of you just sighing all the way through?
this will be a lot of sighing. I think you did, like in your intro, you did a really good job of the racism was really hard to get around. Like I kept waiting for that moment where it was going to kind of go away and that we could focus on a story. It just didn't. even the coloring.
Yeah, it's that pale yellow that kind of
was hard. It was very difficult to get through. The constant, I think, and the pejoratives that were constantly used that I kept waiting, like, again, that was one of the, like, the rhetorical slurs.
Yes.
Used against Asian people.
Granted, they're mostly used by the villains, you know, because they're bad guys, but that's still not okay.
Even the good guys, the like the Blackjack Tar, who was supposed to be, I'm not going to repeat these phrases because I don't want to, but even the good guys would use certain words and stuff. There's been controversy about, let's say, the use of the N-word in comics. And I remember, like, there's a very famous X-Men issue from the 80s that where I think it may have been the last time that it was used in a mainstream comic book, and it was an X-Men, and it was an attempt to do a comparison between the mutants and other people of color. And, you know, it's still very controversial to this day. I want all this to be out there from the get-go. I you know, and you, again, you referenced this in your introduction, but it does tend to influence my feeling about this comic. I can't separate that. I can't separate the two. And I understand that there are, you know, people are always like, well, you know, love the art, hate the artist. But when it becomes a strong part of the narrative, it does make it difficult.
Well, just the nature of the character of Fu Manchu is just racist, flat out. People at the time when Sax Rohmer was writing, in the early 1900s, people were saying, yeah, this is a little racist. So, I mean, contemporary critics, you know, it wasn't even just like, oh, it's a product of his time. No, people at that time were saying, yeah, you're over the top, bro. And then just the legacy of that character and how it's always played by a white guy in yellow face.
Yes.
I mean, even up until after these comics were published, when was Peter Sellers played Fu Manchu at one point?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Even the cover of the first issue that we read is that it's the Fu Manchu in all of his sort of stereotypical glory. It's the yellow peril, you know, he's standing like sort of, he's in the background with his arms kind of outspread, like leering over, you know, again, it's that leering. That
yes, and he has like these bird-like features and pointed ears. Yeah, it's really bad. Yeah, I'm not, there is no apologizing for it. It's not done well.
And I'm sorry, I know you want to talk about the comic, but I feel like it's, And the fact that Fu Manchu, it features in all of these issues. It's not like he goes away. So I think to your point, to start off with, right? So Shang-Chi is Fu Manchu's son, and he is ordered to kill somebody. And of course, what we learn is that Shang-Chi discovers that his father really is evil and then rejects his father. And then, as you've mentioned, goes on this... It's very much a personal questy kind of comic where he is trying to shed the evil that is his father while forging his own path. I'm not saying anything you haven't already covered.
Well, there is a sameness, or maybe I should say formula to these issues. Shang-Chi goes to a place to do a thing. He encounters a martial art themed villain. He defeats the villain, but ultimately feels bad about it and then leaves sad. That's like every issue is just that. It's much like, you know, when we talk about other comics at this time, like Godzilla is the most recent one I can think of. You know, you have creators that were given, it's Doug Monk again, actually. Yeah, it was given a, you know, here, you got Fu Manchu and you have to put Bruce Lee in it. Go. And it just, he's doing the best with what he's got, but built into the concept is just racism and hatred.
And there are just, it's the stereotypes just build and build and build. And it's not just Asian characters. There are some other stereotypes that are done and which we don't have to get into that also become problematic. And I think what frustrates me is that I feel like these writers knew better, but I also know that I get this is the early 70s. What is this, 1972 to 74?
Yeah.
And I'm not excusing anything because of the time period, but also at that time period, I think there was less of a concern.
Yeah, we've spoken about this before. This is a very transitional time when things were very progressive and people were trying to be progressive, but they were still using terminology and outdated ideals from an earlier time. So the language and how we describe things and how we portray things hadn't caught up with the ideas yet. So yeah, so they're still using outdated terms. Like they keep calling him celestial. And that's like, oh man, that is such a red flag.
Yeah.
And that's one of the easier things that they call Fu Manchu.
He spends a lot of these issues developing sage wisdom within his mind and
you know, I mean, I guess it's almost like the writers were trying to make him Qui-Jang Kane from Kung Fu, David Carradine's character.
Right. Yeah.
You know, You know, the sage agent who goes from town to town helping people out while dispensing wisdom. And that just doesn't work for Shang-Chi, you know. Right. I mean, while at the same time trying to make him international spy. And
which is go ahead.
No, and I mean and eventually, like way down the line for this character, they lost the rights to use Fu Manchu. So that's why it had to be written out. But once that happens, they lean heavier on making Shang-Chi sort of, you know, Kung Fu James Bond. And that works much, much, much better than what
we're
getting here.
Which is actually kind of a fun, you know, I mean, Kung Fu exists, martial arts exist, and
right.
And Kung Fu films and comics and things like that are vastly entertaining. They're action-packed. And this is a real, you know, Kung Fu is a discipline that stems from Asian culture. Perfectly legitimate. So, you know, and we've seen in recent years that it can be done well without certain, you know, negative tropes.
Now, I'm not going to excuse this in any way, but we are seeing this from a modern standpoint, with modern eyes. I have seen people online try to argue that there was no good Asian representation in any media at this time. So Shang-Chi, for all his ills, was a leading character and a hero. So the argument is any representation is good. Even if it's flawed, the representation, having that representation was good. I can't speak to that.
You know? No, we don't get to.
Yeah. But that argument is out there. And I want to just make sure that that has been said. And that being said, it's hard. It's hard to read these detached from what we know now. But we're going to try. Because, you know, we are highlighting there's a lot of bad stuff in this. And we are highlighting that right now. But there's some good ideas here. They don't really get fully developed and they don't really come across as well as they should. But there are some good ideas.
Well, sure. And there's one, the arc that I probably enjoyed the most was the bit with Sandy. And enjoyed isn't necessarily the right word because I think, but that's the one sort of, and that took place over several, there were some intriguing things that I thought ended strangely, but at the same time, it's the one arc that kind of captured me in terms of this is intriguing writing.
Yeah.
But we could get to that later. I just...
Okay. Well, all right. So let's get to it. This is a long one and with many, many, many issues to cover. And I don't want to cover each one individually. So right. What I'd like to do, if you're cool with this, Brian, is just talk about the little mini arcs that go through in a general sense. And I'm going to jettison some of the there's a side quest with Spider-Man. I don't think it's necessary. And there's a couple of little side adventures, which are somewhat problematic. And let's just focus on Shang-Chi's quest to topple Fu Manchu's empire, or Shang-Chi's quest to get into a room and have a chat with Fu Manchu. That's pretty much what it is. He doesn't really do much to hurt his empire.
He does end up doing getting into a lot of rooms.
He does. He goes into a lot of rooms and he fights a lot of people in costume. So it starts off, of course, with Shang-Chi's, you know, origin story, where he's sent to assassinate Lord Petrie, who was very good looking as a young man. He was a Petri dish. But he attempts, as you mentioned earlier, he does. Okay, we'll get to this.
He does.
Does he? No, not really, but he does. He does kill Petrie, or who he thinks is Petrie, and then realizes through the backstory given by Lord Dennis, that Fu Manchu's kind of a bad guy and that he's killing the wrong person, basically. So Shang-Chi has regret and decides to change his life. And in doing so, he wants to do something to Fu Manchu. So that's how we start out. His first real adventure, he gets to go to Florida to blow up a boat, and he ends up tripping balls with Man-Thing.
Which is one of the more entertaining portions of the comic.
It actually is. Yeah. So he gets to this, he's trying to blow up this boat owned by Fu Manchu. He's slipped a drug. It's called mimosa. Now, I just picture it as, you know, champagne, orange juice, and mescaline.
Well, this is the early 70s.
Yes, exactly. And if that was a real mimosa, that would have made Mother's Day brunch so much better. But that's actually a very, the idea of being drugged and fighting hallucinations comes up a couple of times in this arc.
It's a running theme.
Shang-Chi has to fight a bunch of people, and then he ends up running away into the swamps where he meets Man-Thing. This is one of my favorite fight scenes in the whole series, because Man-Thing just stands there as Shang-Chi just like goes through him, because he's basically fighting just a big marsh monster full of mud. And it's fun.
He gets caught in Man-Thing at one point.
Yeah, right? he goes feet first and has to be pulled out of him. And these are all great visuals. I think had this comic gone in that direction, you know, the more interesting fights, having Shang-Chi, you know, blow up installations and trying to do spy stuff, it would have been better.
Well, I think the international man of mystery spy stuff would, like, that's perfect for the 70s, right?
Absolutely. In the same way the $6 million man was. He had a mission every week where he had to fight some evildoer using his powers. Shang-Chi fighting some evildoer using his powers and not just wandering through the streets of New York being have racism thrown at him. Yeah.
And then fighting a variety of ne'er-do-wells.
And that in and of itself is fine. I mean, it has a very Bruce Lee game of death kind of thing. You know how in that movie he has to go from level to level and fight a different powered opponent.
And let's give credit where credit's due. There are a ton of fight scenes constantly. Again, just to give credit, they're really well done. The fight scenes, which are many, 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 credit to the artist for the choreography of the fight scenes.
Yes, absolutely. And some of them look fantastic. The main artist... The
caveats should be inherent in my tone, but the choreography is phenomenal.
The main artist, at least on the Master of Kung Fu series, was Paul Gulacy. And he does a great job with these fights. But there's other people. I mean, Buscema's on some issues, and Jim Starlin does one.
Craig Russell, I think, even makes an appearance.
Yeah. So, you know, so... Top-notch artists are on this, and it looks good. So after he leaves Man-Thing, it's basically Shang-Chi has his adventures. He goes back to New York, meets up with Sir Dennis and Blackjack, where he learns about another side quest, MacGuffin-y thing, and then he has to go off and fight more people. There's not really it's kind of like what I said in the introduction. It's just sort of rambling. There's no real through line to any of these stories. He's just go to a place, fight people, go home.
Right, and never quite capture Fu Manchu.
Even though he's always in a boardroom with a bunch of hooded figures, you'd think he'd be easy to catch. So the next major arc on this is what I call Gangsters on a Boat.
It's Tony Montana.
Yes. Yeah.
This is before Tony Montana. It was before, but you know, it's...
A hit has been put out on Shang-Chi for betraying Fu Manchu. So this other gangster, Demi Mustin. Oh, fuck it. Let's just call him Demi. A leisure suited dickhead, basically. And he puts out a hit on Shang-Chi. He hires an assassin named Karain, who's supposed to be the greatest swordsman ever to have lived, who attacks Shang-Chi.
It should be noted, by the way, that every issue features the greatest
of something. Yes. So in the middle of a casino, Karain has a big fight with Shang-Chi. And as he's about to get the killing blow in there, he has Deus Ex heart attack. So Karain, who has apparently been drinking this elixir to keep him young, suddenly has a heart attack right before he kills Shang-Chi, who in his death throws his sword, which hits the girlfriend of the main bad guy. But I want to point out right here that this is not the first instance, but it's definitely not the last. There's a boatload of collateral damage around Shang-Chi.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, innocent bystanders are being knocked down left and right and just straight up killed over and over and over again.
The Buddhist, there's a Buddhist monk that it's just, I don't know if it was a Buddhist monk, but.
Random people just standing in alleyways get killed just because Shang-Chi's around. But yeah, so there's a lot of people in the immediate vicinity of Shang-Chi that gets killed. So of course, as soon as this fight is over, Shang-Chi leaves. I don't know why he was there in the first place, but he leaves, leaving the gangsters to feel very upset. They track Shang-Chi down, they knock him out, tie him to a tree, and they attempt to beat him to death. But then Fu Manchu shows up with his assassins, kills all the gangsters, and then lets Shang-Chi go because it wasn't time yet.
Considering that, you know, he's continually trying to get Shang-Chi killed, but then whenever he really gets to the point of like being able to kill Shang-Chi, he's like, well, the time is not right.
Exactly.
And this comic is filled with that sort of exposition constantly of like, I'm the bad guy and I'm going to explain to you my motives. And I'm not just going to, I've got you right here. I could just put a knife through your heart. But no, I have to set up the death via combat or whatever.
Yeah, it has to be on my terms, not on someone else's.
Yeah. It's like, well, you've got him right there. Just kill him. Well, instead, we're going to put you in this tank with a shark and we're going to do, or whatever, you know.
Yeah. I do want to talk about real quick. Corain dies of a heart attack just before he kills Shang-Chi. Have you seen Monty Python and the Holy Grail?
No. What is this Monty Python?
Well, there's a scene in Monty Python.
We've all seen Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
That was more of a rhetorical question. But there is a scene when Arthur and his knights are being chased around by a monster. It's a little animated sequence. And everything looks bad for our heroes. But at the last minute, the animator has a heart attack and dies. And thus the heroes are saved. There is much rejoicing. That's all I could think of when Courage doing his leap towards Shang-Chi with his sword raised. And he goes, my heart. It's so ridiculous. The series continues. The next kind of arc is a bunch of assassins that attempt to kill Shang-Chi on his birthday, because apparently Fu Manchu wants to take him out on the day he came in. And we get some, again, really good fight scenes with some interesting villains. But ultimately, this goes nowhere. Fight. Oh, darn, he didn't die.
And then the bad guy gets away. Bad guy always gets away.
Yeah. And then Fu Manchu attempts to blow up Mount Rushmore, but Shang-Chi...
That's of all of the randomness in this comic, that to me, that struck me as like one of the most random. You know, it's this big mystery. Well, it's not really a mystery where they are. We're not really presented as it's just Shang-Chi's going to blow something up. But it's not really, Fu Manchu. Is going to blow something up. And we're like, okay, he's just going to blow something up. And because that's what he does every issue. What are we going to do today, Brain? But, you know, and then like, so it all happens, right? And then at the very end, it's like they pull out the camera, as it were, and it's Mount Rushmore. And we're like, and we care why.
And you just kind of go, I can't believe they were going to blow up Mount Rushmore. Would have been nice to know that in the beginning.
I had so that no
there was like some stakes or something. And they were going to blow it up with just jars of nitroglycerin.
Massive rock formation.
Yeah. You're one of the richest men in the world, Fu Manchu. How about a missile? So then that happens. But then let's get to the Sandy arc. So this is the one that you thought was interesting.
Well, it was the one that seemed to have the most through line.
So basically, Shang-Chi is accosted by a drunk guy on the street who he inadvertently throws through the window of a martial arts studio, which is run by a woman named Sandy, who immediately takes Shang-Chi out for Italian dinner.
As one does.
But of course, we find out that the drunk was actually an agent for Fu Manchu in disguise. And Sandy is, of course, working for Sir Dennis. Anyway, they seem to have a little romantic connection.
They do a little heavy petting in the park.
Yes, they do. They do some making out in the park. But then they find out they have to go and save Sandy's dad.
Who's a scientist.
There's several things that happen here. One is, you know, it's all well and fine. They have to go save the scientist. Shang-Chi, you watch the scientist. Make sure everything's fine. We're going to go off and do something else. Then Shang-Chi starts watching bugs. He starts getting all philosophical about a beetle and a praying mantis. And then when he snaps out of it, oh, scientist is dead. Oh, dear. You had one job.
You had one job.
And it just, that's just over.
one, the scientist kills himself because the formula he's working on, which I never quite understood, it was some kind of, it was a serum that was going to save the world or something.
Yeah, it was supposed to be something that feeds all the starving people. Right. But it couldn't fall into the hands of Fu Manchu.
Right. Because then Fu Manchu would have fed the entire world.
Yeah, you don't want that.
And, you know, so the scientist...
He would be Food Manchu at that point.
Jeez. But the scientist was having SADs, right? So he was having SADs that his formula wasn't working, or it wasn't, so he just kills himself.
It's very odd, and it's not really explained all that well. Shang-Chi eventually goes to try to find Sandy, or no, he goes to Fu Manchu, who again drugs him and makes him hallucinate. And during his hallucinations, he has to fight a whole maze. He has to go through a maze. Now, is he really going through a maze, or is that just a hallucination?
Or is it the maze of his mind?
It's the maze of his mind. So he has to fight a whole bunch of people, including Sandy. Does he kill Sandy?
Well, I did not read further. I read the issues that were in this. So I don't know if, you know, this is comics. So, you know, people never really die, right? So we don't know if Sandy ever shows up. The love of his life, whose father he just let kill himself. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, he kills her, or we think he does. It's never.
Well, okay. So he's in the maze.
Just as the text, then he does kill her because she is dead in the maze. And there was no indication that anybody else killed her, and there's no indication that she is still alive.
No, there's an offhand remark that Sir Dennis makes of, oh, we found Sandy's body outside the fortress. She's dead.
Right.
It's like, well, okay. How? No, there's no explanation of why that is. But in the actual comic, the scene is a woman shows up with a skull face that morphs into Sandy, who says, hey, big boy, why don't you give me a kiss? To which Shang-Chi says, this is just a hallucination, punches what he thinks is a vision. But then the next panel is him walking off with Sandy's body laying on the ground. It's given every indication that he actually kills her. And that's...
But he was under the influence, Paul.
Doesn't matter. That's still tragic. And it's given, and it's just given an offhand remark of, oh yeah, we found her body somewhere else. I think this might be a case of the Marvel method gone wrong. That what the intent of the artist and the writer were not quite there.
Could be. I don't...
This might have been seen as something a bit darker than what was presented.
I think one of the... Yeah, and part of the reason I don't want to say like this arc, but part of the reason why I think this is one of the stronger arcs is it actually carries through over several issues instead of just, you know, a one and done sort of thing. And it actually is an issue that seems to have consequences. It also has, you know, the trippy drugged out stuff that was always great in the 60s and 70s. Yeah. They did.
And some really good artwork in this.
Right. Too. And it was the maze scene. Like, so I love, one of my favorite things is like the full page type of things where, and G.I. Joe did this too. And I can't remember if we talked about this, but when you have an artist showing the progression through like a building or do you know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah.
Official word for this. It's the Chris Ware. Chris Ware, of course, in modern times has perfected it beyond all belief.
Jim Starlin used to do that a lot with S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah. And you just have a page where you actually watch the progression of the character.
I'm sorry. Starenko, not Starlin. But anyway, continue. Oh,
right. And so they have one of those, right? With this maze where you just see Shang-Chi chasing, you know, through this maze. And that's like an artistic thing that I love seeing that in comics. Not everybody does, you know, but it's just one of those weird things where it's like, ooh, we got one of those.
And it looks great. And the words kind of follow him around.
Right, yes.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. You're right. This was a decent story arc.
It was a story arc that actually followed a plot for longer than two pages.
Exactly. That was good. But then we get on to the next mission, which I like to call Nazis on a Riverboat.
Ugh. I know it's saying Nazi shit.
Yeah. So they go to South America to team up with Nazis in order to defeat Fu Manchu.
I could, you know, I have no idea. I read it through that several times, and I still don't understand exactly what happened.
But guess what? They get double-crossed by the Nazis. That's a shocker. Usually Nazis are so trustworthy. There is one thing though. All the Nazis wear branded merch. They're all wearing swastika t-shirts. So, you know.
It's very helpful.
They have their little Redbubble account. But yes, Shang-Chi, after fighting an alligator.
He also fought a shark earlier.
He did.
And later he fights a caveman.
We'll get there. Yeah, these are words that we're saying, by the way. He fought a shark. He fought an alligator. Alligators are only in Florida, correct? So if you're in the Amazon, it would be a crocodile.
Oh, maybe it was a crocodile.
No, they definitely say alligator in the comic. But that's what I was... It's like, wait a second. You didn't do research.
To be fair, I'm not particularly well-versed on crocodile versus alligator myself.
I'm sure the writer would say, hey, I'm doing Nazis on a riverboat. I don't give a damn about alligator versus crocodile. So anything's fine. Shang-Chi thwarts the Nazis.
Shang-Chi, that's the British version.
Shang-Chi thwarts the Nazis. There's a few more episodes of Assassins, Assassins, Assassins. And then we get to the search for MacGuffins in the British Museum. Yeah, so they have to search for a MacGuffin in the British Museum because it's something that Fu Manchu needs. And at that point, the display of cavemen comes to life and attacks everybody. And I read this and I said, sure, why not? That should happen.
Not necessarily kookier than anything else.
Yeah, why not? This was actually kind of fun to watch. You know, this was a very interesting fight of cavemen fighting Shang-Chi, who knocks them into the mouth of a T-Rex skeleton, which chomps shut and bites them. Because, again, sure, why not? That should happen.
Well, and is there... Every museum in the Marvel Universe, I believe, has a T-Rex. Possibly the DC Universe as well.
To be fair, if you go to the Science Museum here in Denver, there's a giant T-Rex as soon as you walk through the door. We then get to the arc of Shang-Chi's sister, our stepsister, or not stepsister, half-sister, who starts a civil war with Fu Manchu by taking half of his assassins. And she makes Shang-Chi fight the best villain in the entire thing, Shadow Stalker.
Right.
Shadow Stalker is notable because he has two spiked maces tied up in his topknot that he swings around.
Yet never injuring himself.
Yes, well, he's a master at topknot mace ponytails.
Comics.
Yes, it's glorious and it's wonderful. But Shadow Stalker, he eventually sides with Shang-Chi because Shang-Chi's a noble guy doing the right thing. So, you know, they end up defeating Shang-Chi's sister, who has ruby mind control earrings.
And poison lipstick.
There is a nice little visual thing of, you know, it's three panels with the face of Shang-Chi's sister wearing her red earrings and then a whoosh of speed in the middle. And she's not wearing the earrings anymore because Shang-Chi was so fast. He stole the earrings. It's kind of clever and well done. But then we get to a scene where I was disappointed in the ending, but I kind of thought it was well done. And it's the great meeting between Shang-Chi and Fu Manchu. After Shang-Chi defeats all the martial arts themed villains, he comes face to face with Fu Manchu and they have a philosophical discussion. I thought it was done fairly well. Now you could dispute me on this one, but Shang-Chi or Fu Manchu basically lays out his whole mindset. It's like he thinks he's bettering the world. By taking over, he's the good guy. And that Shang-Chi is the betrayer, you know, and Shang-Chi is basically, he's kind of swayed by this, it seems like, or at least he realizes he can't kill Fu Manchu because if he does so, then he really does become the villain. For a very superficial comic, which is what this is, it's trying to do something, or at least attempting to give a broader, a bigger picture to this story rather than just fight, fight, run away, fight, fight. And then literally the last issue of this collection, it says a new direction for Shang-Chi. And that new direction is meeting Groucho Marx in a taxi.
Right. With Rufus T. Hackstalker, not Rufus T. Firefly.
Right. So exactly. So it's very obviously Groucho Marx driving a taxi. We have a villain named Tiger Claw, who has gloves that are tiger striped with claws on them.
Hence Tiger Claw.
Yes. You know what? Naming yourself as a villain or as a superhero was much easier back in the day.
It was.
But anyway, in this story, two bank robbers hijack a cab to drive into a bank. That cab is pretty resilient, I got to give you.
That is a very resilient cab.
Because it does a lot of smashing into things. These guys, they rob a bank, and then they have their own getaway car, I don't know why they needed the cab in the first place, but they end up stealing Rufus's $7.80.
Which becomes the most important part of this entire story.
Yes, which becomes a quest that he needs this back. So he gets Shang-Chi to follow these bank robbers, which leads to a larger cache of bank, because apparently there's a whole bunch of bank robberies going on. And they eventually lead up to Tiger Claw. Meanwhile, Groucho Marx is basically following Shang-Chi along, just doing banter.
Doing Groucho Marx banter.
Doing Groucho Marx banter, which Shang-Chi doesn't want to help him, but he will if he just shut up. This is funny stuff, no?
It's pretty amusing, not to circle back, but even Rufus T. Hackstalker is using some language that's not, you know, it's just, it's very frustrating because, you know, I want to sit there and go like, oh my God, it's Groucho Marx, one of my very favorite characters in the history of cinema, and yet there are a few moments where he's reduced to using stereotyped language, and I'm just like, can we just let him be Groucho Marx?
Yeah, I know.
Not that the Marx brothers don't have their own issues, or anybody ats us.
So anyway, we ran through a boatload of issues and giant size issues at a breakneck speed, right. And we didn't go into a lot of detail because there isn't a lot of detail.
There's just not.
Yeah.
It's show up, fight, walk away, show up.
And the fight. And as we mentioned, the fights are great. They really do look good. The art is good. Questionable depictions aside, as far as the fight choreography.
Right.
It's good stuff. I mean, there's in this Groucho Marx arc, there's a scene where Shang-Chi jumps over the heads of the two villains to land in front of him. And it's beautiful looking. You know, you see the progress as he tumbles over top of them. It looks good. But unfortunately, there's not a lot of there.
No, there's not. And I think that's part of, if there was more there, it would be, I don't want to say easier. Because I'm not in a forgiving mood with some of the other problems with this.
Yeah. And even... Okay, so I wrote a couple things down. Like, they try to write Shang-Chi's narration as he's always dispensing pearls of wisdom.
Yeah.
And there's one thing like, I have learned to eat the berry and the sprout. Yeah, you're a vegetarian. That's all you had to say was, I'm a vegetarian. But they try to turn it into some kind of ancient wisdom, philosophy of the Orient.
And it's a bunch of
it's platitudes and
a bunch of white guys trying to write.
Yeah. Yeah. But every once in a while, they'll have a line like this one I wrote down that said, he cleaved the air where I had vacated. It's like, okay, that kind of works.
Or it could have just said, I jumped out of the way.
Right. Yeah. There's another one where someone says, I will kill you, Shang-Chi. I show him the falseness of his statement. It works. I'm trying to be nice. I guess I understand the impulse of the writers. And it's not just Doug Monk, because several other writers were on this as well. So I understand the impulse they're going for, but that impulse is problematic.
And I think ultimately, I hate to do this because it's, you know, normally I can't recommend this.
That's like, perfectly acceptable.
We've had some fun with some of the goofiness of the comic that's outside of the, but I just, there's not enough that is, like you said, I mean, some of the action sequences are very well done, but I have to leaven that with how the artist is also presenting stereotypical features. And, you know, the Groucho Marx thing is humorous, but also it's there's still problematic aspects in that. I don't feel like there was enough meat in the story to overcome what I think are the very glaring problems.
I'm not going to disagree with you. It is difficult to look at this from 2021. And say, you know, any of it's okay. It is fascinating as a, I don't know, cultural artifact, if you want to say that, because there
I'm
is
not calling for sense. I'm not calling for this not to exist. I'm not trying to.
No. I didn't think that's what you're doing. Yeah, but there's don't have to like it. But anyway, I do see it as, like I said, a cultural artifact. There was a time at this time, you know, that Kung Fu craze that was hitting the nation was at full stride. And And it's interesting to see how different comic book companies, different TV shows, movies tried to capitalize on it.
Yeah.
And this was something that was very interesting. And it's also not fun, but it's also interesting to see how this character, Shang-Chi, has evolved so that in 2021, there will be a Shang-Chi movie.
Which is why we're talking about this.
Which is why we're talking about this. Leaps and bounds. It's a different character, essentially. They're going to take the most rudimentary aspects of this early series and sprinkle it into the new movie. But even the new comics that have been coming out in the last couple of years.
Yeah. They've definitely been an attempt to distance themselves.
Right. Yes.
A strong attempt to distance themselves.
No, and it's they've done a decent job of it. But there is no question that this is it's not even a product of its time. It's just, it's kind of lazy.
Well, that's a good word, because I feel like saying something is a product of its time gives people an excuse that I don't necessarily feel like is always earned. It's the idea that, like, well, we know better now.
They knew better then, too, but they used stereotypes and shorthand. Yeah, it's lazy. So there you go. I would recommend this simply as, you know, if you want to see what was happening at a particular time in Marvel's publication history, take a look at it. But is it good? I would say no. There are aspects and there are ideas in it that had good intentions.
Right.
But overall, it was not presented well.
It's akin to, you know, reading The Spirit or Winsor McCay's Little Nemo. Two, like, very important works, but with a boatload of problems. And the question is, how do we deal with that now going forward? Yeah, it's a tricky question, and I don't think either of us are attempting to solve it for the individual reader or the person wanting to investigate for themselves. I don't know. I'm going to get for that, I think.
No. You can appreciate this comic for what it does well and still not like it for what it does poorly. Shades of Grey. All right. So here's a comic we both didn't like. Let's move on. Next time on an all new edition of the Collected Edition, what will we be reading?
Well, Paul, because we've been doing all these Marvel comics lately, I thought it would be a good idea to switch things up and do another Marvel comic.
This is the year of Marvel. That's no way around it.
As a DC person, it's really odd that I'm... And it's also odd because I'm recommending something that may actually be a tie-in to something. Not on purpose. Well, kind of on purpose, but not on purpose, because I think it'll already be out by the time I do this. Perhaps I should get to the point. I am recommending the first 6 issues of Marvel Comics' What If?
What if Brian got to the point?
What if he did? So for next time, we're going to be reading Marvel Comics What If, issues 1-6, collected in the Marvel Comics Classic What If, issues 1-6. And just to clarify, it will be issues 1-6 of Marvel Comics What If.
Okay.
In a collected edition.
Some of these are actually, we looked before this show started at what the What Ifs are.
Right.
And some of them are pretty good. And I have read all these at one point in my life, but haven't.
Oh yeah, I collected What If obsessively as a kid. I love those, and some of them were pretty dark. I had thought about recommending, like you and I, picking our favorites throughout at least the initial run. We're talking the classic run. This is the first run of What If, and I was like, then we're just going to get in the weeds. So I kind of wanted to just say, let's just do the first 6 issues. I found out that it exists as possibly an out-of-print collection, but exists as a collection nevertheless.
Yes.
And so I was like, 1-6, let's just do this.
All right, so this will be fun. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. And, of course, we'd love to hear your feedback and comments. You're probably going to hear a lot about this one, because I know people have feelings.
Yep.
So please, definitely want to hear them. Want to hear them on the website, collectededitionpodcast.com. Leave comment on an individual episode and hit us up on Twitter at collectedpod. No. That's not correct. It's Collected Ed Pod, Collected EDPOD. But again, thanks everybody for listening, and keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the program are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. If you'd like to give us your feedback, the show can be found online at our website, collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes, or send us an email to comments@collectededitionpodcast.com. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
Hang on a second. There is a beetle on my computer, and I'm kind of freaked out by it.
Which one is it? George? Paul?
Looks like a Ringo. So
yeah, that's a Ringo.
Yeah, because he's not really doing much.
And there you have something for our outtakes.